From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Eric, Mark, welcome back.
Pleasure as always.
Don, thanks as always.
Thanks for having us.
Yep. So, Eric, you go first. We could start wherever you like.
A lot of the headlines have been dominated in the last week in a number of incidents of international terrorism. And I think this highlights and underscores some of the central points that we've been discussing here seemingly every week regarding the war in Syria, regarding the spread of terrorism, the spread of the Islamic State, and all of these other developments. And now it's reaching into a number of corners of the world. Some of which I think to this point have, if not felt immune, at least certainly felt removed from the quote unquote battlefield that we know in the Middle East. Obviously, the attack in Istanbul is very much connected to everything that's happening with Turkey's involvement in Syria, with the spread of ISIS and so forth. But we also had attacks in Jakarta, and we also had an attack in Burkina Faso.
Right, and you haven't heard either of those two places mentioned on your TV set here in America very much at all in the last like 50 years.
Right. And in fact, a number of interesting developments have been taking place in Burkina Faso for the last 18 months that maybe as background we should probably explain. But
agreed.
At the very least, what we've seen in the last few days is a broadening of the footprint of global terrorism. Now, what does that actually mean? Obviously, the corporate media, the mainstream media in the West has a particular conception of what quote unquote global terrorism means. And obviously, the United States has absolutely no hand in any of this, in the creation of the terrorism, in the spread of the terrorism, and so forth. But right. I think more informed observers understand that terrorism is directly related to a number of the policies that have been pursued by the Western powers, by the United States in particular, obviously spreading from Syria, the collapse of Iraq, and so forth. So I don't want to hog the mic here, but just to point out that what we're seeing in the last few days, and actually this has been going on for a number of months now, including Nigeria, including a number of other countries, is not only the spread of terrorism, but in fact, in the specific case of Burkina Faso, we're once again reminded of the legacy of NATO's illegal war on Libya, because all of the terrorist groups, the terror foothold all throughout West Africa and North Africa, is at its root a direct product of the collapse and destruction of Libya.
Yep, that's true. And there's been evidence that's come out. The Hillary Clinton emails, for example, that was released, that shows not only the direct U.S. hand in some of that stuff, the conversations and more, the payments and things from certain European governments to some of those terrorists, but actually also that war, apparently, it's very strongly suggested by some of the things that are in these emails. It's apparently it was because Gaddafi had enough gold on hand to help back an African currency. That was a topic of discussion in one of the emails. That's the ones we've seen.
Particularly for the French.
Yeah.
Well, can I just point out something, and I'm not trying to take Mark's opportunity to speak here, but I was called the conspiracy theorist in 2011 for suggesting exactly that.
Yep.
I think we all were.
Yeah. And it's just, once again, hilarious that, you know, it's now early 2016, nearly 5 years later, and that quote-unquote conspiracy theory once again vindicated.
Well, that's a pretty good time. 5 years is a remarkably short time for having been proved not to be conspiracy theorists or shall we say, calling the conspiracy what it was. About the, the global terrorist attacks, we can take these three locations, the three most recent. I think some of the most interesting things is that two of them were, we are told, were committed by ISIS, and the most recent in Burkina Faso is supposedly claimed by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. All of these are, shall we say, developing world targets, developing or, you know, or third world targets.
Yeah.
They are all soft targets.
Yeah.
And none of them are what would usually be considered by Salafist Islam as the enemy abroad, as the far enemy, whereas, you know, France, Russia, the United States would usually fall into that category. Some people have speculated that this indicates that ISIS is weakening, that they are the cost of the Russian and Syrian offenses, and the Americans and the Iraqi army on the other side are having a toll on ISIS. I'm not quick to jump to that conclusion. I think that
especially there was the latter part.
They were probably in place for some time already to have been enacted as they were. You know, certainly the elements and much of the planning. I, particularly with the Istanbul attack, I would simply like to say that the facts are not all clear, that they are extremely murky, that there have been a lot of absolutely ludicrous statements out of the Erdogan regime, and that absolutely nothing that it says with regards to, well, the Istanbul attacks or anything really can be taken without a very, very large, you know, grain of salt.
And they're contradictory. You know, their statements are contradictory. They are
not only that, let me also, and for Mark, because I want you to expand this a little bit first, and there, Eric, jump in. You know, there's a palette of these incidents, too, and that you have to fall into, you know, that you have to characterize differently, at least, you know, on an inquiry until you're satisfied of about the nature of each of them. Who knows Istanbul? My suspicion is, you know, perhaps more having to do with the attacks on the Kurds that the Turkish government has made. And then they've also attempted to add some incidents in Europe and the United States to the list of terrorist attacks that, you know, one of them falls more into the category of homeless guy finds a gun somewhere and shoots somebody, and then instead of saying I did this for mommy or Jesus or Mickey Mouse, says I did it for ISIS. And suicide by cop, the same thing. Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to blow up the National Bank or the White House or something and stand there with a toy gun, now they say I'm with ISIS. Those are not really terrorist attacks, and I agree, I think maybe you could embellish this some, Mark, that the attack in Istanbul can be distinguished from Burkina Faso and Jakarta.
Yeah, well, the fact that I haven't had the details of the construction of the suicide belt. However, I would venture to say that this is not something that the average emotionally or mentally disturbed individual is going to cook up on his own. It does take some modicum of skill and experience to fashion such a, you know, suicidal device. So I'm not gonna, you know, it's not simply picking up a pistol, at a Walmart in the United States.
Yeah, I'm exaggerating and just to illustrate the idea, though. That's just to illustrate the concept.
But I really must say again that I do not trust any information that we have thus far, particularly about the Istanbul attack. We've already heard trying to blame it on the Kurds.
Right.
We've heard three the Western press announces them as Russian nationals arrested in Istanbul. And there's there was a kind of attempt to connect this with the terrorist attack. This is, of course, so ludicrous because we know very well who these Russian nationals. Yes, they are technically Russian nationals.
Right.
They are. I don't want to say Chechens because that word is misleading. We shall call them members of the Islamic Caliphate, in the Caucasus. They could be ethnic Chechens. They could be ethnic Ungush. Mm. They could be Dagestani, perhaps a few others, Tatars or others. You know, and of course, there's even some Russian converts to Salafist Islam, Russian ethnic. But that's who these people are. And Turkey, of course, well knows they are because they've been sheltering them there for more than 20 years. Right. This is where they operate out of. This is where they go to school. This is where they train. This is where they relax on vacation when they're not fighting in the hills of the Caucasus. In fact, there was a piece in The Guardian just a few days prior by, you know, the Russian resident food critic, Sean Walker, who basically wrote a teary-eyed swan song for a actual ethnic Chechen jihadi who was killed on the streets of Istanbul while doing his high street shopping, evidently, living up the high life. And of course, there's no proof about how he was killed, but you know, the entire article, even the title, is focusing on how suspicion lies on the Kremlin. They read a teary-eyed swan song for him. And then just a few days later, there's like, oh, my God, there's evil people from the Caucasus in Turkey. I wonder if Russia had something to do with it.
Yeah, Putin did it.
Completely incongruous from, you know, the prior report. So it's all rather – it would be amusing if it weren't so very, very sad and pathetic.
Like, I want to add a couple of things to this story here because, you know, as I mentioned when Mark was talking, not only are we not to trust what the Erdogan government has to say, but in fact, they've put out, from my count, and I haven't followed it minute to minute, but from my count, at least three different explanations, each of which kind of cancels out the previous one. They're all contradictory.
Which is two less than the number of explanations the U.S. gave for how their riverine gunboats ended up in Iranian waters. Erdogan and the United States are competing to outbull the quantity and of bullshit. Answers they can give about how each of these incidents happened.
Bullshit has now superseded any other products as the number one export of the United States.
Yeah, now so I'm going to have to edit this.
We're looking at a race.
Anyway, just on, you know.
Hold on. Let me.
I just wanted to ask, do you think it was Gilligan and the skipper that were piloting those ships?
Yeah, really. Well, it ended up being far more than a 3-hour tour.
Yeah, right.
I just want to say that the aggression of these Iranian territorial waters surrounding these riverine boats, you know, within the 12 nautical mile limit, the Iranian water is so provocative.
That's right.
I gotta say, based on the pictures that I saw, I might let the Iranians capture me as well. Get a nice little trip to Iran,
feed them
some tea, whatever.
Iran is about to make unilateral visa-free travel with Russia.
That's right.
We'll be visiting Iran.
Well, I'm not going to discuss any visiting of Iran right now. But anyway, I do think that there's something very important to be said here. Number one, I think that we have a track record with Erdogan, Davutoğlu, and especially with the MIT, with Turkish intelligence. Obviously, we can point back to the assassination of Serena Shim, Press TV reporter, American citizen, gunned down most likely by Turkish intelligence because of her reporting on the activities of the Turkish state in collaboration with Al-Nusra Front and some of the other terror groups. So
actually, we smashed with a truck, I think, actually, is how she bought it, right? Didn't they?
Right.
A truck broadside her. It disappeared from the face of the earth.
Right. So we had that. We had that example. We've also
didn't we also have a former BBC journalist reporting in Turkey hang themselves?
Yes, yes, yes. There's a number of mysterious deaths. We also, of course, know how Erdogan is persecuting the journalists inside of Turkey, Can Dündar and some of the others.
Academics, 12 academics arrested yesterday for daring to speak out against the military campaign against the Kurds. This is a NATO country.
Right.
Turkey is a NATO country and an EU association member in aspirin.
So my point here is not to just, you know, do a laundry list of Erdogan's crimes. I've written multiple articles doing that. What I want to point out here is that we shouldn't put anything past Erdogan's government in terms of what kind of dirty tricks they might use, including violence, in order to be able to affect a political agenda. And I think Erdogan correctly in this regard knows that there is a demonization campaign on against him, obviously from the Russians because of the downing of the Russian jet. They've been going hard after Erdogan. We are seeing even in the West certain circles, particularly those, of course, tied to Fethullah Gulen and his network, which are in bed with the CIA, who want to see Erdogan brought down and their faction come to power in Turkey. And so with all of these different machinations sort of floating around in the air there, we have to then look at Europe and notice that a lot of the support that Erdogan once had in Europe has really collapsed. And some of that has to do with Turkey no longer seeking admission to the European Union. Some of that has to do with, I think, in particular, Germany and France not backing Erdogan as strongly as he might want. So with all of that being said, to me, the first thing that struck me, just as it did with the terror attack in Mali in Africa about a month ago, was the victims. And I believe the victims were, at least 12 Germans, by far more Germans than even Turks, who were killed in the attack. Now,
yeah, German tourists.
To me... I'm not suggesting that necessarily indicates that they were the target. What I am saying that it is curious that once again, we have a terror attack inside of a country where the target are foreign nationals and specifically nationals of a country that in some sense is being targeted by Erdogan. We've seen that repeatedly. Erdogan has made comments about how the Europeans have not backed Turkey strongly enough, that they're wishy-washy about Russia and so forth. So,
Not only that, there's the thing with the EU.
The EU, which they've now pretty much abandoned.
Which Germany is largely responsible for.
The European Union countries basically gave €3 billion of blackmail money to Turkey to keep more refugees from Turkey. And evidently the Europeans are extremely upset because Erdogan isn't upholding his end of the bargain and keeping the refugees in Turkey as they continue to come into Europe. And you know, it has to be said that only about half of these are actually from Syria. A lot of them are coming from all over, from Afghanistan to Libya, from all over the Middle East and North Africa. But the Europeans, first of all, it has to be said that support for Erdogan in the European Union for Turkey in general was always pretty much American pressure.
It was tepid support. But they didn't see Erdogan as a villain. I think that there are some now who do.
And then Jakarta. Indonesia, apparently they just opened a hospital in Gaza. Is that what I saw?
Before we move on to Indonesia, I want to make one other point about Turkey and Erdogan, if I could. And that is that if you've noticed that every time there has been a significant terror attack inside of Turkey, and I'm thinking over the last 18 months, at least certainly in the last 6 months, including that really awful attack during the protest there, the question always arises how Erdogan is going to translate this into a political currency and into a military initiative. And each time so far he's done it, he's used it as the pretext to attack Kurdish targets. And I think that most likely that's exactly what we're seeing here again, that this incident is the pretext by which Erdogan will say, you see, Turkey is the victim of terrorism, the victim of all of these groups, and we have to strike at them. But when they say strike, what they really want to do is strike the Kurdish targets. And now I would propose one final point here, that this more than anything has to do with Russia's charm offensive with the Kurds. The Turks fear more than anything that the Kurds of Turkey and the Kurds of Syria turn away from the West and become allied with Russia and tangentially in a de facto sort of way with the Syrian government. If that were to happen, not only is Erdogan's project of regime change in Syria a failure, but now Erdogan's own regime is certain to fall.
And you know, that's true. Whether the Turkish government committed the incidents or is just repositioning them. Right.
Right.
Or just taking it, exploiting. Right.
Exactly. That's, yeah. And that's the point I'm making, because I can't say definitively the Turkish intelligence did this.
It almost doesn't matter.
But I can say that we do know that they've done stuff like it.
That's right. That's true, too. And it almost doesn't matter who did it, because what's happening right now is exactly as you described.
Right.
Now, just this week, we've gotten the word officially, it's been in the works for a while, that Turkey – this is the openly, you know, proudly proclaiming their neo-Ottoman intentions, Erdogan regime, now has three foreign military bases.
Yep.
Iraq, which the Iraqis have, despite all the protests, have not been able to dislodge all of Erdogan's forces from Iraq. Somalia.
Yep.
And Qatar, where there's also, of course, U.S. military bases. The last thing this world needs is a rabid dog like Erdogan with military bases in Africa and the Middle East. It is really terrifying.
Yeah, it's
the
like
U.S.
a
has announced
empire, right?
New plans this week. New plans for Syria. They had the most recent attempt. The FSA has at this point long abandoned, at least openly. Although, of course, the CIA continues to smuggle, tons of tow weapons to them through Saudi Arabia, and they continue to be paid out of these U.S. operations centers in Jordan and in Turkey. But there was an attempt to move to the Syrian Democratic Forces, this newly branded force that suddenly appeared. That, of course, were 95% Kurds, and the other 5% were some Arab tribes that had been beat up on by ISIS and had no really choice but to gravitate to the Kurds, who were successfully resisting ISIS in the area. In fact, some of those same tribes had previously fought the Kurds, but that's the way these conflicts pursue. But the U.S. has already essentially lost all control of the Syrian Democratic Forces, and this whole plan is going up in smoke because Russia has quite brilliantly jumped on this. Oh, you want to say that these are Syrian opposition forces, the Kurds who have never fought against the right. Syrian government?
Right.
Okay, we'll jump on that and go with it. The Russians are now openly providing the Kurds with weapons for close air support. The Kurds are moving on exactly where Turkey doesn't want them to. And Russia is openly spilling propaganda all over the front pages saying Russia's not only supporting the Syrian Arab Army, we're also supporting 10,000 Syrian opposition who are advancing on ISIS. Of course, the fact that these are just the Kurds, that's neither here nor there. It was the U.S. who tried to rebrand them as such, and Russia is running and going with it for all the propaganda it's worth. It is establishing strong relationships with the Kurds. And the latest announcement of plans, of Syria plans out of Washington, make clear that the U.S. is about to openly turn on the Kurds, whatever relationship they've had with them so far, in favor of Turkey. And it is going to once again try to create, to train, to conjure out of thin air a moderate rebel force. Supposedly, these are going to be trained in Syria, but they are going to be picked by Turkey this time. Of course, if you've been paying attention last time, you would find that the Pentagon also, when they managed to train their four or five last time, also had Turkey working as a filter to select them, at least initially. So that's absolutely nothing there. But this new U.S. plan in Syria is the exact same as the old plan,
right,
to conjure up more proxies and to keep this Jarablus corridor that's funneling arms, weapons, jihadis to Ahrar al-Sham, to the Islamic Front, to Jabhat al-Nusra, and of course is providing the oil transit route for ISIS and Turkey back and forth. They have to keep this open because the Kurds are pressing it from one side. The Syrian Arab Army is just rolling. They're making a lot of important strategic advances in northern Latakia, on highways around Aleppo. within a few months, they could really threaten this corridor. And the U.S. and Turkey are scrambling to do everything they can to keep it open. And they're doing it under the rubric of the fight against ISIS. But of course, they're not. No one that the U.S. is backing is actually fighting ISIS.
You know, hold on a second.
One addition to everything Mark said there. And it's really just a reiteration here. A few weeks ago, I remember we talked at length about the Kurds, and it was an important discussion. And I just want to bring back one key point here for people who've been following the conflict in Syria and all of this, all of the attendant issues, to remember that the Turkish Kurds and the Syrian Kurds are distinctly different from the Iraqi Kurds.
Yes, that's an important distinction.
And these factions are not simply differences in terms of shared history or anything like that. They're very much functions of political power. And in the north of Iraq, those Kurds are controlled by the Barzani and Talabani clans. The Barzani and Talabanis are hated by Kurds in Turkey and in Syria.
And there we're talking about the PKK and the YPG.
Right, exactly.
Communists now, the reason
that's important is because it is still a fact in 2016, despite all of the attempts otherwise, that those Kurds in Iraq are essentially U.S. and Israeli proxies, more or less.
Right.
The Kurds of Syria, the United States would love to have made the Syrian Kurds into proxies the way they did with the Iraqi Kurds. And what the Russians have done, making inroads with the Syrian Kurds and with the Turkish Kurds, of course, the HDP party, representatives of the Turkish of the Kurdish party in Turkey recently going to Russia. All of these moves by Russia has been, I mean, obviously it's about creating allies and forming alliances, but really it's not even so much about making the Kurds into allies for Russia. It's depriving the Kurds of being proxies for the United States. That is the ultimate logic behind what the Russians are doing.
It is also, of course, payback to Turkey.
Yeah, the shooting down of the SU-24. Of course. Yep. Yes.
And, you know, Mark's point about, or he mentions the advances that the Syrian Arab Army is making now, which we all know has been, you know,
really
going
impressive.
On.
The Russian air campaign is having a very important effect on the logistics, the supply lines, the economy, and the morale of the whole host, the 31 flavors of jihad, from ISIS to Al-Sham.
Here, I wanted to make this point before. Hang on a sec. This is the point I wanted to make, which is that they fought for a good 4 years alone, and they held off this onslaught. They lost territory, but they protected Damascus. They held off this onslaught.
They supported most of the population centers, 70% of the population.
Yep, that's right, under all of those conditions. And then the Russians come in. Suddenly, first of all, you have the satellite surveillance capability that they didn't have before. So they can look at the whole picture the way that the other side was able to do before. And now, of course, you have the air power of the Russian Air Force. And so with those things and the morale, I think that can't be underestimated.
There's also one small thing I'd like to mention. There's a very good piece you should read if you're interested in the military side of the things and War on the Rock, War on the Rocks, that talks this last week, that talks about how Russia is also basically rebuilding the Syrian Arab Army from the ground up, with an emphasis on artillery and combined arms operations, which they had lost in the post-Soviet era. And this is really enabling the Syrian Arab Army to batter their opponent from a distance, move up, take and hold territory like they weren't doing before. So even when Russian and Syrian Air Force aren't present, artillery can provide that advantage that their opponents don't have.
Now, it also shows rebuilding the capability by the Russian military to fight a non-nuclear war if someone decides that they're going to fight a war in Europe or Asia.
Yeah, I want to add a couple of other points here since we've now gone back into Syria to mention that, and I had a piece on this last week, the situation on the battlefield, and the very, very important was the assassination of Zahran Alush, the leader of the Jaish al-Islam group, the Islamic Front. This is a very, very...
Let me just jump in there as a hype man. If you haven't read Eric's piece on this, please drop what you're doing and go and read this, because this was a beautiful, in-depth report. I learned things I didn't know from it, and I just want to shout the praises of this piece.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And I want to stress as well, I'm not a military tactician. I'm not suggesting that, you know, I can give all of the detailed analysis of all of the different, you know, really technical military stuff. But from the battlefield perspective, there is an important principle coming across here. The killing of Zahra Nalush really sent and a number of other leaders of Jaish al-Islam really sent that group into disarray at the very top leadership levels. And this was a very top-heavy organization, one that was incredibly dependent upon the power of personality of Zahra Nalush. This was the single most powerful group in Ghouta, in the Ghouta, East mm-hmm. Ghouta suburbs of Damascus. Now, just to clarify, Ghouta is a region, and within Ghouta, you have that city of Douma, where we had the market attack last summer that they tried to blame on the Syrian Arab Army for a collective punishment. When in fact, I documented that in fact it was targeting precisely this group, which was embedded in Douma right next to the marketplace. Now, the killing of Zahra Nalush in late December of last year, and now we had a couple of weeks later, the news came out of the killing of the leader of Ahrar al-Sham in the territory of Homs. Now, look at a map and look at that north-south corridor at the from the north in Idlib, include Latakia, go down further through Homs, Hama, through Damascus, and into Dera all the way in the south. This north-south corridor is now being compartmentalized by the Syrian Arab Army. They're breaking through in key strategic locations in order to isolate each of these cities and to isolate the groups that are operating within them. This compartmentalization is fundamental and absolutely essential for the Syrian military to be able to achieve something significant on the battlefield, namely the pacification of this entire corridor. Now, it doesn't include Aleppo, it doesn't include Deir ez-Zor, it doesn't include Raqqa, of course. These are strong, especially those last two, strongholds for the Islamic State that will require a different kind of a push, but that is happening as well. So there are changes on the battlefield that are directly related to Russia's involvement and the Syrian Arab Army increasingly being able to penetrate these areas. And I think that is critical. And one other point I made in that article, though, and I think that people, especially supporters of Syria, need to be very conscientious about this. There will not be a total victory on the battlefield in Syria. The final resolution will come at a negotiation process at the negotiating table. The issue, what's at play now, is who is going to be able to sit at that table and who is going to have the leverage. From all indications on the battlefield 2 years ago, that was the United States and its terror proxies. Today, it is the Syrian government that will have the leverage.
Right. Let me jump in there a point. I just want to jump back big picture on some of the things you said there. A lot of the Western press you will be reading will be complaining that Russia is not attacking ISIS or not attacking ISIS enough, that they're attacking West-backed rebels. Russia had made very clear from before they even started the military campaign, back from Putin's UN General Assembly speech, before Russia put any troops on the ground in Syria, that their priority, their plan, and they have a long-term strategic plan, something the United States is completely lacking. Any ISIS or any kind of Islamic state, a Salafist state influenced by Saudi Arabia and Qatar taking over Syria or part of Syria is a huge national security threat to Russia and a geopolitical chip they cannot endure. They will not endure. To do that, they need forces on the ground, and no one can take out ISIS and these others in the long term other than the Syrian Arab Army. In order to sustain the Syrian Arab Army, you have to secure the government. So Russia's priorities first are to secure the Damascus state and Alawite heartland, then resume the transport corridors north and south. Then it will be to close the Turkish border. These are the first steps, but it will all be building up to a larger land campaign. They're already, of course, fighting them in multiple locations against ISIS, but also, as Russia has always said, and other terrorists. And by terrorists,
that's right.
Russia defines terrorists as meaning, yes, the Al-Qaeda, which, of course, the United States and the UN also recognizes, that's Jabhat al-Nusra, as a terrorist group, Ahrar al-Sham, who is an Al-Qaeda offshoot, the Islamic Front, and anyone who works with them, which is the FSA and basically everyone else on the battlefield.
That's right.
Right. My definition of moderate is, bear with me here, I'm a simple, my roots are a simple blue-collar military guy. My definition of a moderate is you are not and have never allied with ISIS. We'll take the FSA out of that because they've already allied with ISIS.
Right.
You are not and have never allied with Al-Qaeda. You don't chop off people's heads in the name of your God.
Uh-huh.
You don't suicide bomb.
Right.
You don't resort to cannibalism.
Right.
And you don't want Sharia law inflicted on Syria or any other country. And that pretty much takes at least 95% of the so-called rebel opposition in Syria.
And also, Mark, all of those groups that Mark is just talking about, I want to just stress this just so that we have an even bigger picture here. And I know obviously Russian intelligence knows all of this. Every one of those groups that was just named, with the exception of the Jabhat al-Nusra, but Ahrar al-Sham, Jaish al Islam, the Jaish al-Fatah coalition, all of these groups, they have all recently come back from a convocation in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
They are Saudi proxies, whether in a direct sense, such as Ahrar al-Sham, or in an indirect sense, such as, one of the other allied fighting groups that are on the ground there. That's how Russia is seeing the big picture geopolitics here. Russia knows what kind of an economic war is going on right now with the oil prices and everything else, and the role that Saudi Arabia is playing in all of this. Yeah. Russia understands who the Saudi proxies are on the ground in Syria, and so whether it's the Islamic State that Russia's bombing or a Saudi proxy, it's all part of the same conflict if you're Moscow.
That's right. Now, not only that, one of the tests that ought to also be applied for people going to the table, which is going to, again, reduce the population significantly, is nationality, because a lot of those fighters aren't even Syrians. Many of them.
We know 30,000 to 50,000, according to the UN, are foreign jihadists.
Okay, so
yeah, but a lot of them are front. A lot of these organizations are fronted by token Syrians who could easily sit there and represent them. I don't know.
And
that
maybe
that's
a means test for that too. Maybe a means test for that too. I'm not saying it means you can play. I'm saying if you're not Syrian, leave the room.
No, I know. What I'm saying is that there are many organizations that at their root are not really Syrian, but they're fronted by Syrians, so,
Well, take a look. Saudi Arabia tried to dress up. The big problem that Kerry, the United States, and their allies have now is how to dress up people who have actual power on the ground in Syria and put them into a negotiating room. And we're talking Ahrar al-Sham, Jabhat al-Nusra. And Saudi Arabia tried to do this with Ahrar al-Sham, and there's the potential there to draw off much of al-Qaeda's fighters and relabel them as Ahrar al-Sham and bring them in as part of the political transition. They couldn't handle Saudi Arabia's convention. They were allergic to even the words democracy or secularism being spoken, even if it was all said with a wink and a nod by the Saudis. I disagree with Eric. I don't think there is a political solution. I think the Russians are well aware of that. I think that they are in this for the long term. They are making the requisite diplomatic gestures, and they hope that at some point, perhaps at least the West will give up on all of this, and that will at least drop a lot of the money coming into the West to fuel this, and then they can simply deal with the Saudi and Qatari supported forces.
I'm not,
but so they don't have any faith in a diplomatic solution. How do you negotiate with a hard al-Sham?
You got to ask, what is the solution?
How do you negotiate with Saudi Arabia and Qatar? You don't. The Russians know this. They have a long-term high attrition strategy for taking Syria back and rebuilding it. Don't think they will accept any type of Sunnistan or Salafistan out of any part of Syria.
That shows a bigger point, okay? I mean, when you say a solution, is there a political solution to Syria? Well, you have to ask, what do you mean by a solution? Because do you mean peace and elections in Syria? In the context, the same context that bred this conflict, which is really a proxy war by Saudi Arabia against Iran and a proxy war by the United States against Russia.
Well, look, I hear what you're saying. I'm a little bit maybe more skeptical of certain aspects of, or let's say skeptical of some of the assumptions in that. I understand, obviously, the difficulty or impossibility even of having, genuine negotiations if you're including all of these different groups. However, the idea that Russia is going to engage militarily long term, and it depends, I guess, what we mean by long term, I'm not so quick to believe that quite yet. I think that there is a number of indications that globally speaking, that to me at least signal that Russia would like to have some kind of a solution where they can, quite frankly, and I mean, if we're going to be really sort of cold about this, so that they can stop spending so much money on this.
That's part of the thing. It's not actually very expensive.
I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. There's some debate about exactly how much is being spent by Russia, both with regard to what they're doing in Syria and in general with the military. Obviously, whatever aid Russia has provided in Ukraine, what they're doing in Syria.
That's a different story.
But it's not a different story. They're connected because this is about how Russia is acting internationally when it comes to its military. And the question, look, it depends on who you want to read. But there are some people in the international press who have at least some level of, genuine understanding of Russia, who are arguing, in fact, that Russia is going to have to decrease its military spending because of the collapse of oil prices, because of the sanctions, because of some of these other things. So I'm not sure that I see Russia having an appetite for a long-term engagement in Syria, especially one that's going to cost them billions upon billions of dollars if you're talking about a rebuilding process. So while politically I understand what you're saying, I still kind of believe that practically speaking, there's going to need to be a political process, and Russia comes out in many ways stronger because of that, because they now have taken the mantle of peacemaker away from the United States and have brought themselves not only in the military sphere, but have announced themselves in the diplomatic sphere. I think that Putin sees that as a very real strategic benefit for Russia in the long term.
You know,
let me talk about what Russia means by a diplomatic solution here. Their idea of a diplomatic solution, in my mind, is that the West realizes they've been completely insane and going against their own interests at some point, if elections have to happen before that takes place, and that the West withdraws from this. Of course, there'll have to be some kind of recognition that a few liberals in the Syrian National Council or whatever current body the U.S. is manufactured out of exiles in Arlington and Istanbul's coffee houses that have absolutely no influence on anything that's going on the ground and no military strength whatsoever in Syria, no real political representation. Russia will agree that they are part of some political transition. It's a sop to the West.
Of course it is.
To do with any of the forces actually fighting on the ground.
Of course,
and
that's what I'm saying.
The ability of Saudi Arabia and Qatar to stop backing them, is very difficult to foresee.
But this is okay. I guess maybe we don't have as much disagreement as I thought from your initial comment, because that's exactly what I'm saying. That the terror groups that are on the ground in Syria right now, they're being destroyed. They're being cut off. The Syrian Arab Army, if you read the official Syrian news outlet, the Sana, the Syrian Arab News Agency, or you read anti-Assad news outlets, the situation is clear. Tactical gains are being made by the Syrian Arab Army meter by meter, you know, mile, kilometer by kilometer, whatever, that they're being made slowly but surely. That to me tells me that they are shaping the situation in Syria long term for a political process. Eliminate those players that cannot be included in a political process. Let the rest of the gusanos and the, you know, the U.S. backed proxies and whatever, let them have a seat at the table, then move to this political process wherein it can be managed by both the U.S. and Russia and other interested parties. That's a huge victory for Damascus and for Moscow. That's what I see them going after, not some kind of, you know, unconditional surrender and total capitulation on the part of all fighting groups on the ground. I don't see that.
No, I'm looking at it. I just want to go to the point about how long Russia can sustain what it's doing. You know, we hear about the Saudis, you know, they've been conducting an air war in Yemen every day since March. And, you know, they're suffering from the oil decline, and their economy is, I think, even more dependent on oil than Russia's. Let me finish. So I hear about all the time that, you know, well, they have these gold reserves, but they have about a quarter of the gold reserves that Russia has. I mean, Russia could spend and pay its own manufacturers, by the way, to build weapons and just churn them out for a good long while before it's exhausted. They haven't scratched that.
Yeah, but Saudi Arabia. Well, yeah, but Saudi Arabia doesn't have the economy that Russia has. They don't spend on poor people, on social programs,
understood,
on all of these other
all
things.
Of that
Russia
understood.
Has a lot more factors in its budget built in. The Saudis would just let people starve. They don't care. You know what I mean? Like they could. They'll continue doing this as long as they feel that they can.
They're already reducing subsidies on gasoline and other things.
Exactly.
But the Saudi regime is also a lot more fragile.
Yes, that is true.
And the quagmire in Yemen is starting to tell, as the Shiite minority in the east is evidently rising up. They've had such problems. Let's take a look at Yemen a little bit, some of the developments that have happened there. In the last week, we've heard previously about hundreds, if not thousands, of Colombian mercs have been brought in by the United Arab Emirates and others of these countries, because evidently the Saudi forces, these armies that have been bought and paid for, with tens of billions of dollars of Western high tech equipment, the Saudis can't fight. They can't. Right. They have no ability.
Right.
They have no military instincts or traditions
or troops
to build on.
The troops are not reliable either.
No, the mercs weren't enough. Then we hear in just the last week that we've got 800 Egyptian troops that are being brought in. And not only that, but rather quietly, the UK's Foreign Secretary Hammond has openly admitted that British advisors are there on the ground with the Saudi troops. Repressing the people of Yemen.
Nice.
This has escaped the notice of a lot of people. So once again, the United Kingdom, we know the United States, like the UK, has been providing C4 ISR. Every time Saudi runs out of cluster bombs, they're quick to refill the cage. And of course, everything Saudi is flying and maneuvering is all U.S. And that's what's going on with the Saudis.
Okay.
Eric, please tell us about Burkina Faso.
Yeah, please. Yeah. And, you know, you might even give a little background back to Sankara.
That's what I was
okay.
going to do.
All right. The geopolitical context is, start with that.
You know, Burkina Faso is interesting that, well, it's interesting that we're seeing these developments in Burkina Faso. And actually, it's a country that doesn't really make headlines traditionally, and yet it has made headlines a couple of times in the last, year or so. Remember, Burkina Faso is an important country in West Africa, particularly because of its history. Burkina Faso had one of the, I guess we could say, one of the last true Pan-African revolutionary governments led by Thomas Sankara, who was vehemently anti-international aid, anti-Western. He was interested not only in, obviously, in socialism and things of that nature, but in self-reliance and independence for mm-hmm. African peoples and yep. for African nations. And he was, of course, assassinated by the recently deposed head of the Burkina Faso government, who was, in effect, a proxy of the United States. So mm-hmm. Burkina Faso has been more or less a client of the United States since at least the 1980s. And we can say that, obviously, historically. We can also say that practically, if you look on the ground, Nick Turse, who is probably the preeminent investigative journalist with regard to U.S. military in Africa, an issue that I follow pretty closely as well. He's documented all of the bases, and I've written about it as well, all of the information and surveillance and military infrastructure that the United States has developed all over the African continent. Burkina Faso is home to one of the major U.S. drone operations mm-hmm. in West Africa outside the capital city of Ouagadougou in Burkina mm-hmm. Faso. Now, when we see a government that is, in effect, a client government of the United States deposed by a people power movement mm-hmm. that holds up portraits of Thomas Sankara
right.
and removes the government that is allied with Washington, does anybody really believe that there's not going to be some kind of a counter move against Burkina Faso? I, of mm-hmm. course, expected it from the very moment that they deposed the previous government. Now, what we're seeing in Burkina Faso now, there's a very real question about what exactly has happened there, who is perpetrating this, and why was it resolved the way that it was? A government minister taken hostage with a number of other individuals, and then they're freed by whom? What was the process? There's a lot that still remains unknown about what happened in Burkina Faso, but geopolitically and strategically, it figures centrally in what the United States is doing. Remember, the United States is now moving out of Ethiopia. They have closed their drone base, their single drone base in Ethiopia. They are moving it to Cameroon in West Africa, part of the Lake Chad Basin, where all of those countries and, of course, the Boko Haram insurgency, Chad, Niger, where there's also a major U.S. drone base, Cameroon, soon to have a U.S. major drone base, Burkina Faso, all of these countries in that region. So you can see a strategic realignment by the United States towards West Africa in particular, and I think that's how we need to understand everything that's playing out in Burkina Faso.
Well, and it also happens in the context of the U.S. relationship with France, using France, the former colonial power, as its front, basically, and both by allowing space for France to follow its own imperial aims, and certainly for providing a context for that.
Yeah, and the U.S. has kicked open the door to not only France, but imagine Germany.
Right.
Germany rearming itself and sending its military abroad, which is almost like unfathomable for people born post-World War II. Mm-hmm. But that is happening now, and Germany is embedded in Ghana. Germany is now expanding a military presence in key countries in West Africa. All of this, in my view, is part of a major push by the U.S. and NATO powers against Chinese encroachment, what they see as Chinese penetration of West Africa. I think the instability and violence in Nigeria figures as part of this narrative. And what we're now seeing, what we saw in Mali, what I argued is a targeted assassination against Chinese and Russian nationals, in particular, high-ranking Chinese business officials. That happened quite recently. And now we see in Burkina Faso, a country which just recently deposed a U.S. puppet government. All of this, I think, is part of the same narrative.
Hey, Mark, let me ask you something. When I was in Tripoli in 2009, there was, it looked like Houston in the 80s, okay? There were cranes everywhere. They were putting up hotels and all kinds of office buildings and everything else. And most of the construction work there was being done by South Korean companies or Chinese companies. Now, if you think about Sankara's vision in Boko Haram, in Burkina Faso, and you think about Gaddafi's vision and his gold reserves, and you think of China's interest in Africa, they could have, if they were allowed to stay in power, they could have pursued a project jointly for the development of Africa that would benefit China, Russia, and others, and build indigenous industry, which is what Sankara's thing was about.
There's no question. I mean, Gaddafi in his older years was getting a little eccentric, but there's no question that the African nations viewed him with a lot of respect for everything he's done for them and for the continent for decades. And if there was one figure that could have galvanized resistance to the U.S., and at the same time, it must be said, galvanized alliance with China and their development vector for Africa, it would have been Gaddafi.
Yep.
And I think we have to look at the events, not only in Burkina Faso, but in Libya, in Somalia, in Algeria, and go back a little bit further to Sudan, as all part of the U.S. strategy of using military force to push China's economic force out of Africa. And along with China, of course, in the last few years, there has been a resurgence of Russian influence. Again, while China pursued the infrastructure and development vector, Russia went for what it's very good for and invested in energy. Energy sources, Niigas and others.
And by the way, military hardware.
It's all geopolitics.
By the way, military hardware, too.
Military hardware, of course, Russia.
And just watch, just to add to what Mark was saying, just watch what's happening in Ethiopia. I have a piece coming out this week, and I argue Ethiopia is one of the central battlegrounds in Africa between U.S. and Chinese influence. And the fact that the U.S. just closed a base, their only base in Ethiopia, which just a couple of years ago they opened and invested tens of millions of dollars in, I think that there's a narrative, there's a story to be told there. And I think the story is, if we look at the quotes from the U.S. military officials themselves, when they opened the base, they said, this base will stay open as long as the Ethiopian government wants to cooperate. They said that when they opened the base just a few years ago. Now they closed the base. Does that mean the Ethiopian government is no longer cooperating with U.S. interests and U.S. military? Well, if you look at the fact that the Chinese have funded to the tune of almost $600 million a major dam. The Chinese built the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa for $200 million. They built the capital city's light rail infrastructure, which is now the envy of the African continent. The Chinese have made not just a foothold, the Chinese have become the dominant player. And those are the words of the former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia, that China is the single most important player in Ethiopia today. That's why you see the U.S. making the moves that it is. It needs to realign its military and surveillance infrastructure and power projection on the African continent to head off what it sees as a major push by the Chinese, including the fact the Chinese now have a new naval facility in the African country of Djibouti to secure
major foreign base.
Exactly. Okay. And it's not just anywhere. It's in Djibouti. Securing the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, access for the Chinese to the African continent, right up
all
against Ethiopia.
All right, guys, it's been a pleasure as always, and we'll hook up with you again next week.
Beautiful. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Take care. You've been listening to CPR Sunday with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.